Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of H2O Talk. I'm Tom Bellinger.
And I'm Tom Check.
And we are Drip and Drop, the Fawcett Brothers. And today we welcome you aboard. We're going to talk today a little bit about the Mekong River. But first, let's go into a little water news. And there's one article that Tom and I have been looking at. Essentially, this is on the Colorado River. And this is a study out of the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. And this basically is stating that the Colorado River Basin has lost enough water to fill Lake Mead due to climate change.
A lot of water, Tom.
That is. That's a full fill. And basically, they're looking at the climate change. What the researchers have figured out is they did this study from 1880 to 2021. One thing they've noted is that the Colorado River Basin temperature has increased by 1.5 degrees approximately, and that's Celsius, due to climate change, leading to about a 10% reduction in runoff. So that would be a lot of that water that's lost.
We were talking earlier that 1.5 degree increase makes a difference for the aquatic wildlife and all the other wildlife in the river. That can affect spawning habits and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Food issues.
Yeah, for sure. And just that loss of that amount of water in the river, you know, that's one of the things that they've been trying to model with, trying to cut people back to almost maybe save maybe the equivalent of a Lake Mead fill. That's a huge task at hand.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And we've talked a lot about climate change in the Colorado River, but we thought we would just touch on this one for a minute or two. It might bring a perspective to you about how much water we're missing in that river.
Yeah. Things are changing.
Things are changing, and I believe it's about 40 million people that depend on that river. So not too great news. We'll have to see what happens. Now, maybe this year we might recover a little bit, but we need several years like this to fully recover.
Right.
Okay. So, Tom, now we're going to get a little bit into the Mekong River and some of the work I did over the past few years.
And was that work you did while you were at the Bureau of Reclamation, or was this contract work afterwards?
It was essentially contract work afterwards. The Department of Interior has an international technical assistance program, and the various agencies feed people into it, and they bring in people that are, I guess, active duty, ongoing employees, and they also pull from people who have retired from Interior. So I noticed this project was going on and put my name in for it, and essentially I went down with a team of two people. Actually, three people. There was one guy who was retired from Fish and Wildlife Service, and he's actually was our team lead because he does a lot of coordination. And he was a fish epidemiologist. So he wasn't quite a hydrology person, but there's a lot of fisheries work going on through this program. So he's busy. I came in as a retired hydrologist from the Bureau. We also brought a regional hydrologist from the Fish and Wildlife Service out of Portland. And we had a woman from the U.S. Geological Survey who is the national sediment expert for the agency. So very high-powered people. You know, I had to kind of try to catch up again to them.
So logistically, you leave the States, you fly to Vietnam, and you get off the plane. How do you connect with the locals and start your work there?
So we head out. And we flew into Vientiane, which is the capital of Laos, and we were working in Laos, where most of the dam building activities are taking place, the big dams. Basically, we would be put up in a hotel, and we would connect with a few people from occasionally maybe the embassy, U.S. Embassy. There is a Mekong River Commission, much like the Colorado has, but we also had a team assigned to us of some hydrologists from the Ministry of Natural Resources and the Ministry of Energy. Basically, we formed a team of about maybe 10 people. And since we were learning, they took us around the country to various spots. We saw some dams under construction. We looked at their way of doing their work and analysis. And it's funny because our original mission was to go and look at their data collection network, their analysis technology that they did, modeling, and we are also going to assess what climate change might be doing to the river on top of building all these dams.
What was their data collection system like? Was it pretty robust and up to date, or what was that like?
So their data collection system, when I looked at the network on a map, I thought it was very robust. The problem was the equipment was all in disrepair. So the Mekong River Commission gave each country some money, and they built all sorts of data collection equipment, the stream gauges, meteorological equipment, etc. And when they essentially finished that, they gave them 5 years worth of funding. When we went down, the 5 years had been over for, you know, maybe another 5 years. And they did not have the money to really maintain the equipment. So essentially, most of the equipment was not in good working order. They one thing you do with stream gauges is you have to recalibrate them with something called a rating curve. You have to look at the geometry of the river. And that river shifts all the time. It's a very muddy river, like the Mississippi. Essentially, the data became suspect. A lot of the meteorological equipment wasn't working except for the airports, which is a requirement in aviation. So we also noticed that they did not have, as far as equipment in the field, it was in good working order. Boats weren't really working or had holes in them. Engines needed repair. And actually, one person told me that we don't have enough money for gas to get in, put in our truck so we can go out in the field.
Wow.
So it turned into a bit of a salvage operation. And the technicians really didn't get a lot of training, so we essentially turned it into a program to help train their technicians on hydrology and how to do their job.
That's amazing. Now, the Mekong River Commission, I don't know anything about it. When was that created?
Not sure of the date. I'm going to say it goes back a few decades. It's a lot like the River Commission on the Colorado. So you have seven states on the Colorado River. Here you have six countries that the river flows through. And the commission is in Laos, Vientiane, the capital, right on the river. They have a variety of different people with different backgrounds working there. And their mission is to manage the river and coordinate between the countries and provide any funding, anything like that for studies. And this is really was set up because this is such an important river on the planet. It's very biodiverse, 20,000 plant species, you know, around 500 mammals. I've heard from 1,200 to 2,500 fish species. Matter of fact, they still pull things out of the river that they've never seen before.
Wow.
So here, and I have a little note here, it says estimated 850, but I've heard that it could be much, much more. And it is the world's largest inland fishery in the world.
Did not know that. The funding for the River Commission and for the dam building program, where does most of the funding come from? Like World Bank or?
Mostly from China. So there's a lot of agencies involved. When I went down there, there were people from the Corps of Engineers, from Department of Interior, some from academia. We ran into people from basically some European countries, France, Germany were also working. But as far as the money for building all of this infrastructure, it's mostly from China. So they're doing the big investment.
Yeah, interesting.
The river feeds, I mean, it's so important. 70 to up to 90 million people rely on that river for protein. So it's a pretty important resource.
Now the dam construction program, what are the purposes of the dams? Hydropower, irrigation, those sorts of things?
Yes, so hydropower is the biggest component. And So when you talk about the countries here, you're looking at Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. Now, Vietnam has become pretty developed, but Laos and Cambodia are still considered third world. They are going to be betting, or they were betting, on these dams to produce hydropower, and they were at least nicknaming Laos the Battery of Asia. Most of the power was going to go to Thailand, which has really been developed. And they were looking at least about 11 main river or main stem dams, and then hundreds of small dams on the tributaries. So the river was going to change drastically from all of this construction. And the one dam that was being built called Zyberi up in the northern part of the country, that was nearly complete. We went to see that under construction. A lot of people from Europe, a lot of people from China were working on that dam. One of the issues that they were noting is they were building these dams without any fish passage. Now, Zyberi, they did put in a fish passage structure so the fish could migrate upstream, but on the tributaries, not really any fish passage.
Culturally, did the dams enhance the local culture and economy and so forth in terms of families and so forth, where people worked?
Well, most people, as far as the people in Laos go, they were pretty happy people, well-fed. They were looking forward to maybe some of this income coming in to pull them out of the third world. But there's been a lot of collateral effects of these dams. And I'll tell you one story. When we were leaving from our last trip, and our last trip was just before the pandemic hit, so basically we haven't gone back. There was a gentleman from the U.S. Embassy who was new to the area. He had a sociology background, and he was talking about some of the effects on the people that are in the rural areas. So the river is changing. The river levels are changing. The fish passage is different. The sediment flow has been modified quite a bit. And he said what has happened is in the past in the rural areas, there's still kind of a hunter-gatherer type of subsistence living. So the husband traditionally goes out and hunts and fishes and brings the food home. The mother stays home with the family and raises them, and essentially that's how the jobs are segregated between the husband and wife. But what they've noticed is a lot of the fishing, the number of fish that they've found in the river is decreasing. Some of the game animals in the area have declined quite a bit. Some of that's from poaching. For example, like tigers have been poached. And so the environment is changing quite a bit as far as land animals, vegetation, and fish. So the husband, who was traditionally going out hunting, was now not bringing home much game and not bringing home much fish. So the families were getting into a stressful situation. A lot of times what would happen is the husband would decide, I'm going to have to move to one of the cities and get a job and send home money. That's how we can survive. So that's what happened. A lot of the men left the area, went to some of the bigger cities, got a job. And the funny thing about it is he says, well, inevitably, the husband would find that he kind of liked the city life and probably would find a girlfriend, and suddenly the money would stop going to the family. That put the wife and children in a vulnerable position for trafficking, human trafficking. And there is a large center for human trafficking in this part of the world, and essentially the sex trafficking or just labor trafficking, whatever, could essentially exploit these families that were in need. So he said that's a bit of a distant consequence of building the dams and changing the environment.
Wow, that's remarkable. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Now, one thing that they're also trying to do with the dams, which is maybe more of a benefit, is flood control. They do have a lot of flooding in this area, and that's one benefit. We've had several teams go out there looking at fish passage, looking at the changing conditions, and the consequences of building all these dams was getting to be so dire that the nations that are downstream of Laos were starting to get worried about their own situation. Well, the other nations essentially proclaimed they were no longer going to build any dams, or they were going to put it on hold. And the last holdout that actually did that was Cambodia. They said, okay, we're not going to do this because we're noticing the effects on some of our natural resources. The people in Vietnam were the ones that were really being hit, because this river flows into the Mekong Delta, and that's a huge agricultural area. And the Mekong Delta is getting hit from both sides. So you have ocean rise, and you have saltwater intrusion, and then you have a reduction in flow and sediment that goes into the delta. So the delta is essentially, you could say it's dying in a lot of respects, and that's a huge resource for Vietnam for food, crops. So they've been protesting against the dams, or basically saying that they don't want to see this. Laos is the last holdout. They probably would benefit the most from the dams, so they are still continuing the build. But downstream, there are certainly effects. There's an interesting area downstream, and I'm just going to pull up a note of mine. It's a large lake, and it's basically at the border of Vietnam and Cambodia. So and one of the things also is with the flooding, well, I'll get back to that in a second. I was going to talk about the delta, but let's talk about this little lake here. It's the Tonle Sap Lake. And this lake, essentially, there are floating villages. And this is an old tradition that's been going on. What happens is the lake in the springtime rises, and people can kind of move their villages around that are basically floating villages, and then later in the year the lake level drops, and they tend to push them towards the center of the lake to keep it floating. So there's a big cultural thing here. It's interesting because there's a one day of the year the river that flows into the Tonle Sap reverses its flow. So it comes from the high flows, and then when the flows go down it reverses, and they have a big ceremony there where they, and there's a couple videos on this where the boats are on the river and you can see them moving in one direction, then it kind of slows, and then they start moving in the other direction. So that's a big, almost like a holiday type of thing. And that's all changing, and that lake is not getting the water flow that it used to. So there's another cultural aspect that's being harmed. And I did mention the delta. The delta is getting that seawater coming in, and so they have more flooding. It's very low-lying, so a lot of these areas are getting flooded with salt water. That destroys the soils and crops. The Mekong River, which could counteract that, has lower flows because of the dams, so it's a bit of a double whammy for these folks. So there are consequences, and you know, China is investing in a lot of places around the world. They're investing, I think, like the Panama Canal infrastructure in Africa, and this is one of the big projects here that they could have. Another thing is that China will also get probably the bulk of the profits from hydropower, at least for a while. The deal, as I understand it, is after Cambodia, Laos, they would get some of that to help them out. But the deal is after 20 years, China would turn over all the dams to them and let them operate them and essentially own them. But after 20 years, those dams are going to be needing more repair and maintenance. So it's not quite a good deal for them, despite all the things that they have to figure out. So Tom, when we went there, we realized that the data that they have, everything that they had, at least in Laos, was not really good enough to analyze the river conditions and the forecast, what's going on in the future.
Fascinating. You know, China investing in those dams and then returning it back to the local countries after a period of time, after they generate their revenue. Kind of like the HOV lanes in Denver, where the Australian company, I think that was the Boulder Road, an Australian company pays for the HOV lane. They take the profits for 20 or 30 or 40 years, then they turn it back to the local government. It's the same strategy. It's interesting.
Yeah. When I lived in New York, we had the Route 90 New York State Thruway. It was a little different situation, but they said that we'll pay for the road by 1990. and then we'll take and then we'll tear down all of the toll gates. Well, 1990 came and went, and they kept the toll gates up. It's right. still much cheaper there than it is with these toll roads that they're building in Colorado. But they kept the tolls going, and I guess what they said is we're going to put it towards education. So, but I mean, that's okay. But they never did take them down, as everyone expected.
One thing I noticed, so that's a lot of dams on the main stem of the river, the Mekong. The dams cross international boundaries between countries.
Yep.
Because the river is the boundary. The cooperation needed, there you go, the cooperation needed by the various countries, did the Mekong River Commission kind of shepherd all that through somehow?
They do. When they actually, countries decided not to build dams or to continue with the dams, that was a bit of a cooperative effort. Now, of course, China's a big player here. They're one of the countries, but they're the ones that have the money. But there are six countries, and they do tend to cooperate. We did talk to people in the commission a little bit, and I was gathering some frustration. There's going to be issues just like we have on the Colorado River between states. Yep. But essentially, everyone backed off but Laos. And some of these dams, I mean, they're big. They're huge. And interesting stories, though, I guess between international types of things, is a lot of the hydrology people, there's a town on the south part of the country called Paxi, and they were explaining that sometimes when they have a good working boat, they'll go out and start doing some water measurements or temperature measurements, whatever they're doing on the river. And if they accidentally cross into Thailand, Thailand gunboats come out.
Oh, my gosh.
And occasionally shoot at them.
Oh, my. Have you
so,
like Nevada having gunboats if they're going to try to do something.
Yeah, they said occasionally they've been shot at, probably more warning shots. But they said, yeah, there's still a little bit of tension along the river in some spots for various reasons. But it really was a fascinating situation. And I was hoping to maybe go back. I've been looking at a lot of the money also for our side does come, there can be some UN funding. USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, provides a lot of funding and some coordination. But one of the issues that I noticed, and I asked our embassy person from the U.S. Embassy, is I said, we're really confused because you have all these teams coming out and there seems to be a lot of duplication of effort. I mean, do you really need us out here? And they have a lot of work going on with fisheries, fish passage, hydrology, not as much right now. Some people looking at building some fish passage structures. Some people might be looking at social aspects of this, but I would say right now fisheries is the big thing. Because that river, like I said, 70 to 90 million people get fish out of that river, and all the nutrients and sediment flow, it's all changing. Just an example I was reading the other day, and this goes back a couple years, is the water as it flows, like from Cambodia into Vietnam, the color has changed. So it used to be kind of a sandy color thing because of all the sediment, like think of the muddy Mississippi. Right. That water is, for a lot of time of the year now, is running clear because the sediment's all being held back by the dams.
And where would that sediment be?
Behind those dams. And so that, you know, and nutrients and things like that can get trapped. So it's changing the chemistry of the river. What's interesting, water, if you take a lot of sediment out, it becomes sediment hungry and it's more erosive too. I haven't heard of erosion problems, but I'm sure some banks are getting that type of.
Now, you made a couple trips to this area for this work?
Yeah.
And while you were there, did from a security standpoint, did you feel any pushback being an American over there doing some work,
or not?
Was it, were people kind of following or listening in on your work from governments?
Not at all. We did meet with people from the government. We met from Ministry of Mines and Energy, Ministry of Natural Resources, and we met with their ministers and their higher ups. That all went very well. I think they were happy to have us there. And as far as the general population there, I felt no fear. I probably felt safer there than I do here sometimes. They were very friendly, very happy people. The one thing I would ask them is, I would say, can you tell me a little bit about maybe the government or something like that. And they say, well, we don't generally talk about the government. So they kind of left that out. But they were a well-fed population. They seemed to be a happy population. They loved where they lived. So I would say they were, by and large, a fairly content population of people.
Interesting.
And the cities were very nice, but you know, you could see a wide variety of very primitive living to very maybe high-tech type living in some parts. But I think the problem is, as with a lot of countries, is money is sent in and it doesn't quite make it down to where it was intended to go. So, you know, people were on computers where the numbers and letters were worn off on the keyboards. They were still using dial-up connections if it worked. So yes. if they could really develop those agencies and allow them to go out and collect data, recalibrate their equipment, maybe upgrade or repair their equipment, you would have a great data collection network that probably could tell us a lot. And the people I went down with were really great. They were very talented, and people wanted to do something, make a difference down there.
On a different podcast, we'll have to talk about the trip I did to India with MSU Denver.
I would love to hear about that.
When we checked in the hotels there, they would use a mirror to check beneath the cars before we checked in the hotel for bombs.
Wow.
You had to run your luggage through a bomb detection, like at an airport, before you walked into the hotel. I was really surprised by that level of security there.
Well, you know, in Laos, I could you occasionally see somebody in uniform, a police officer or a military person, and they were occasionally you'd say hi or whatever, or maybe you have a little conversation, but they were always just kind of matter-of-fact friendly.
In India, at the airports, there'd be a soldier with a weapon at the door, checking your passport before they let you in. And there were security people in the perimeter of the airport.
Did you experience that in Rome?
So if you're at the major landmarks, let's say the Vatican, the Pantheon, and so forth, there was always a military vehicle with a big machine gun mounted on top, and then two soldiers with machine guns all day, all night long. And I read a month or two ago, someone drove into the Vatican and was trying to ram a building or something. So that's why you have folks like that there.
Wow.
But the main churches, always a guard meaning a military person with a armored vehicle with a machine gun, always there. It kind of made you feel safe.
Well, I remember the airport. When we were coming home, a lot of armed people with basically assault rifles all over the place. And, you know, something I hadn't seen, I'd seen it in other countries, but I was not expecting it in Rome. So their security level was very high.
Right after 9/11, you know, you go to the Denver airport, they do the mirror beneath your car, and there were soldiers with guns, and it was like, you know, it's gone, it's reverted to this.
Yeah. And over here, Laos, I did not really see that much of that. And that's a communist country. I've been down into Cambodia, and I would say it was similar. They were friendly to tourists. And one part of Laos that is a big tourist attraction is a city called Luang Prabang, kind of in the center of the country. It's a World Heritage Site. And it has a lot of old temples and things, and it's like the city is like a cafe community kind of feel. Oh. A lot of cafes, restaurants. It was a fun place to go. I thought it was a neat city, and that's where you ran into a lot of tourists from Europe and the U.S.
I was going to say, how about expats, people living in this part of the country?
I know that there are some. There were people I suspected as being expats in some of the restaurants, so yeah. But I don't think there's quite as many as you would see in other countries.
Yeah. Fascinating.
So another, you know, river in the world, another natural resource in the world that's being affected by, I guess, progress, change, technology, and it would be very interesting to see what it looks like in 20 years. But, I mean, hopefully this will help their economy. But hopefully it won't really devastate the river. Just a few of the dams are built now, and the river's already changing. And if they built like all 11 main stem dams in Laos, that would be a huge change factor for that region.
I was trying to think, how many main stem dams are there on the Colorado River? I can only think of two.
Well, let's see here. I'm thinking of tributary dams. There's down as you get down towards Mexico, there's a few. Okay. One, two, but you've got Parker Dam, you've got Lake Havasu, you've got...
Oh, yeah.
So there's several more on the southern end of the Colorado. And then our other dams, like on the Green River, Flaming Gorge, those also. And this particular situation down in Southeast Asia is a lot of small, a lot of dams on the tributaries. Those tributaries... we saw a few of those dams, and they're big concrete gravity type dams with no fish passage. So
this is a bit like the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority.
In a way, yes. Yeah.
The construction, I think, was in the 1940s and 50s, primarily.
So yeah, and this is being built. So, like I mentioned earlier, is most of this power is going to go to Thailand, which is needing that power much more than the other countries. And China will probably take some too, but
fascinating.
So it was a good experience, and I hope to head back. This program does do other countries, work with other countries and various different things, and I kind of keep my eye out for different opportunities. So
international travel is life changing, isn't it?
It is. It really is. I think it's a great thing to see how other people live, look at different architectural lines. I think it opens your mind a lot.
Yeah, and you and bet. It sure does.
It does. And your experience in Italy, I mean, you get to stay there for months at a time. That's great.
You know, and you learn there to slow down and enjoy life. It is a remarkable different cultural experience over there that you can bring home with you then.
And I would say for me, this was a little bit like that. You could kind of slow down and maybe look at the countryside, look at the vegetation, stop by different temples. And so you weren't like in a rush to get business done, so to speak. So
yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Thank you.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about your experience in India maybe next time or the time after.
We can sure do that. That was really an interesting experience. Wildly good and bad at the same time. That's what was remarkable about it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we're pretty much on time here, Tom. So any parting words from you?
Not really today. I enjoyed learning. I know very little about this part of the world, and this was a fascinating overview.
Yeah, and for me it was, in the military I served in basically the Asian part of the world, but I had been to Vietnam and Cambodia, Thailand before as a tourist, but not really spent this much detailed time down there. And it was to me it was kind of like life changing, I would say too.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Okay, well, to our listeners, thank you for joining in with Tom and I. We will have another episode in, 2 weeks, Tom?
2 weeks. Sounds good.
2 weeks out. We will have this thing once it's up. Just stay tuned for our next episode. Yay. Tell your friends about us. We'll try to get some more listeners as we go. We're going to have more guests. We have a few more slated in the future, which will be kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess all I can say is, good luck, everybody. Enjoy life, and we will all see you next time.
Take care.
See you, Tom.
See you, Tom.